everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week, I'm very pleased to say we have Alan Steinweiss on the show, and we'll be talking about his terrific new book, Kristallnacht, 1938. One of the fundamental questions in modern German historiography is whether the Nazis created a new kind of German culture, a Nazi German culture, or whether there was something in German culture that gave rise to the Nazis. Most attempts to answer this question have revolved around the feelings and beliefs of so-called ordinary Germans, and they have concentrated on the activities of those Germans during the Holocaust. Alan, however, asks the same question of an earlier episode in Nazi anti-Semitism, and that is Kristallnacht, 1938. He asked the question as to whether ordinary Germans were prone to anti-Semitic violence prior to Kristallnacht, or whether the Nazi party itself was behind this particular spasm, or pogrom, as he calls it, in 1938. He does a terrific job of answering this question, and the question is a good one and one that deserves serious consideration. So we should congratulate Alan on this book. I enjoyed talking to him today, and I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
Vermont.
Yeah, Vermont. You're in Vermont. That's exactly right. How are things in Vermont?
We're enjoying the mild winter, except for a 32-inch snowfall a couple of weeks ago. It's been a mild winter.
Yeah, we're not enjoying a mild winter here. You spent some time in the Midwest, didn't you?
I was at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln for 15 years.
Exactly.
Before moving here a year ago.
Yeah, so we had a big ice storm last week, and it's quite beautiful but quite deadly. So we haven't had as much snow as you, but it's pretty treacherous out. I should tell our listeners we're talking to Alan Steinweiss today, and we'll be discussing his terrific book, Kristallnacht, 1938. I've read a lot about Kristallnacht and the Nazis, and I have to say that this book was a revelation to me. It said many things that I did not expect. It's a terrific example of the use of heretofore unemployed sources, some of which were remarkably detailed, and I hope we get a chance to talk about that. We'll also be talking, I guess, in a couple of weeks to a historian who used a similar sort of source base, that is, these trials that were undertaken after the Second World War, and Alan mines those trials for Kristallnacht. It's quite incredible they had them at all, I think, but in any event, it's a really wonderful kind of set piece example of the clever use, the really clever, intelligent use of sources to reconstruct an event that it turns out we really didn't know as much about as I thought we did, or I'll only speak for myself, as I thought I did. So, Alan, congratulations on the book. Let me ask you to begin by telling us just a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am a professor of history at the University of Vermont in Burlington, where I also am the director of the Center for Holocaust Studies. Your listeners may not realize that the field of Holocaust studies in the United States, one can argue, actually began here. One of the great seminal historians of the Holocaust, Raoul Hilberg, who published the great work, The Destruction of the European Jews, came to the University of Vermont in the late 1950s, fresh out of graduate school. And at a time before the academic world was paying any attention to that subject. And he published that great work in 1961, and then a second edition and a third edition in the 1980s and then the 1990s. And ultimately, the academic world caught up with him. But we're proud here that we consider the University of Vermont to be the birthplace of the serious academic study of the Holocaust. I spent 15 years at the University of Nebraska before coming here, and before that I had spent a little time at Florida State University in Tallahassee. Did my graduate work at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where I was a colleague in graduate school with a couple of your colleagues there at the University of Iowa. I worked under Gerhard Weinberg at Chapel Hill, an eminent historian of Nazi Germany and the Second World War. And before Chapel Hill, I was educated, I'm working my way backward here, I was educated at the State University of New York at Binghamton. I'm a native of Brooklyn, New York, and grew up in New York City.
Right?
In Brooklyn.
Yeah, I didn't know that Hilberg was at Vermont. I had no idea about that.
Yes, he spent virtually his entire academic career here.
Well, it's supposed to be a very pleasant place. I don't doubt that he found it such. Yeah, his name and I guess it's Lucy Davidovits. Is she thought to be the other sort of founder of the field in the United States? I don't even know where she was located. I have no idea.
She was based in New York. I forget at which university. They were very different scholars, very different kinds of scholars. And Hilberg was more of the empirical, archivally focused research scholar, whereas Davidovits was a bit more of a synthesizer and a bit more of a popularizer. Mm-hmm. They did have their disagreements, specifically over the issue of Jewish resistance and more generally the Jewish response to Nazi persecution and genocide. But she is certainly a member of that same generation. I would argue that while Davidovits was more successful than Hilberg as a popularizer, that Hilberg's work has stood the test of time much better among academic experts in the Holocaust. It really has become, his work is really part of the kind of the intellectual and the research foundation of what many of us do in a way that Davidovits's work is not so much anymore.
No, I read both of these books as undergraduates on my own, and this was decades ago. And I found them both eye-opening. I think I also remember that Hilberg appeared as a commentator on The World at War. Is that right? You know, is that right?
You're probably thinking of Claude Lanzmann's show.
Oh, yes. No, I am. I absolutely am. Yes, that's exactly right. Yes, he did.
Right.
Yeah, I remember seeing
it. There are actually some stunning scenes of Hilberg being interviewed by Lanzmann in Hilberg's home here in Burlington. If you're a scholar and you're watching Shoah, those are among the most compelling scenes in the whole documentary, because Lanzmann builds Hilberg up almost into kind of a hero of the film. It's the scholar reconstructing from the documents what happened and how things developed.
Well, it's a nice juxtaposition between Hilberg the historian with the documents in his hands in Vermont and then these interviews with people, many of them polls, some of them not, about what they had seen. So it's a good juxtaposition. But I do remember seeing Hilberg, the films of Hilberg with the documents in his hand and him explaining in a kind of dispassionate way, as you say, what was going on there. It would be impossible for me to be as dispassionate as he was about attempting to establish what happened.
Right. And being able also to tease meaning out of the most innocuous looking passages in a document, his ability to kind of read between the lines or to interpret features of a document.
Yeah, I remember this. The Sonderhandlung, the special handling, he talks about that, what that might mean, you know, and clearly it's a euphemism for murder, really. And that was really quite that sort of language that the Nazis used to hide what they did. Did you ever get a chance to meet him?
Oh, certainly. Even though he retired from Vermont in the early 1990s, and he passed away in 2007.
Oh, really?
Which was
okay.
A couple of years before I came to this university, but he was an active member of the field until he died.
Uh-huh.
And I certainly, I had the honor and pleasure of meeting him at conferences.
Yeah, it must have been a remarkable sort of intellectual journey for him, because although the Nuremberg trials did a lot to uncover what had been done during the Holocaust, I don't think it was really until serious scholars started to go to the archives that we really understood what had happened. And I have to imagine that for him, it must have been quite shocking to see it all unfold.
Yeah, well, actually, in the first edition of Hilberg's work, the 1961 edition, was based very largely on the documentary record that was assembled by the prosecutors at the Nuremberg trial, although not all of the documents that he used actually were presented at the trial. But during the organizational phase before the trial, the Allied prosecutors, you know, put together, they assembled this vast archive of documentation, and Hilberg had access to that. I believe he used a set of the documents that had been deposited in the library at Columbia University, where he received a PhD.
Yeah, no, it really must have been a fascinating career. Let me ask you this: how did you actually come to write this particular book?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's a good question, and you know, this is one of those subjects that I've been fascinated with ever since I started reading systematically about the subject of Nazi Germany and the Holocaust as a college student in the 1970s. This idea that in a modern civilized country, and in a society in which discipline and order are very highly valued, that there would be this kind of national level kind of spasm of violence, I just found fascinating. And, you know, as I was a graduate student and then a junior scholar working on other subjects, I always had in the back of my mind the notion that I would one day write a book about this. The problem was that, you know, it's a subject that has been written on previously. There are other books on the subject, and the subject features in larger, more synthetic works on Nazi Germany. And as a graduate student and a junior scholar, I, of course, had to find something new and original to write about. You know, if you want to get your PhD, get tenure, and, you know, distinguish yourself on the job market as a beginning scholar, you have to find something new and fresh. And this subject was not a candidate for that, but ultimately, I kind of got to a stage in my career, having published a couple of books previously, where I finally was able to, you know, work on something I really felt like I wanted to. And I also came to believe, you know, as a scholar working and teaching in this field, that even though there's a lot out there, there really wasn't available in the English language a good, short, readable, synthetic work on the subject. You know, if you were teaching a course, let's say an undergraduate university course on the Holocaust, as a student, you know, a bright undergraduate came up to you and said, "I want to read on the Kristallnacht. You know, what can I look at? And I don't read German." I really don't think there was anything to recommend to that student other than to go to some of the broader works on Nazi Germany and, you know, read this chapter or read that chapter. So I was trying to fill a lacuna in the English language literature. And I set out to write something that would be simultaneously synthetic, that is to say, that would tell the whole story pretty much in a way that could be understood by a non-specialist. But I also hoped to have something new to say about the subject. It's an argument-driven book. It's an interpretive book, and I was very, very interested in the question of the extent of the participation of so-called ordinary Germans in the event. And one of the key questions that I put to the evidence was whether there had been as little kind of spontaneous joining into the riot as is often presented in the scholarship on the mm-hmm. subject.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe we should talk a little bit about the scholarship on the subject. Obviously, this is one of the major topics in modern German historiography. That is the extent to which there was a kind of, one wants to be very careful here, a kind of native German anti-Semitism that was tapped by the Nazis, or whether the Nazis were the sort of standard bearers of a new kind of anti-Semitism. This has been debated very much by all of the senior scholars in the field, including yourself. Let's begin our discussion by talking about the ways in which the Nazis had sort of prepared the ground for Kristallnacht. Can you talk a little bit about anti-Semitic propaganda and anti-Semitic measures prior to 1938, from 33 to 38?
Sure. Well, in the opening introductory chapter of the book, I mean, the book really focuses, most of the book is about 1 week in Germany in the month of November 1938. There is an introductory chapter that provides the necessary background from the beginning of the Nazi regime in 1933 until November 1938. And the central question, I think, as we look at those years from 33 to 38, you know, with respect to understanding the Kristallnacht, is the central question is, you know, to what extent the anti-Semitic program of the Nazi regime was legal and was pursued through legal or bureaucratic means, and to what extent was it did it depend on violence, either grassroots violence or organized violence targeted at the Jewish community? Now, there's no question, and I think the existing scholarship is quite clear on this, and I don't fundamentally disagree with it. There's no question that the anti-Semitic program of the Nazi regime from 1933 until the end of 1938 depended primarily on legal and bureaucratic forms of marginalization and exclusion. The Jews were defined as a distinctive racial group, not merely a religious minority, but as a distinctive racial group. And once they were defined as such, they were systematically deprived of their legal rights, their rights as German citizens. They were systematically purged from a wide variety of professions and occupation. They were systematically deprived of their property. There was a very complex program that the Nazis referred to as Aryanization, the systematic transfer of Jewish-owned property. This would be personal, let's say, real estate or businesses, from Jewish hands to so-called Aryan hands. And there were Jews, there were measures put in place to physically segregate the Jews. This had not yet taken the form of ghettoization. That mm-hmm. only really happened later. But, you know, there were communities that, you know, prohibited Jews from, you know, like sitting on park benches and things like that. So, you know, taken together, all of these measures, you know, constituted a legal and bureaucratic assault on the Jews. And then you have this massive eruption of violence in November 1938. And traditionally, in the, you know, in the historiography on the subject, that event is depicted as basically, you know, having come out of nowhere, that it was this kind of unprecedented, sudden explosion of violence targeted at Jews that had really kind of no basis in the behavior of the Nazi regime toward the Jews for the previous several years. And I think one of the central contributions I try to make in my book is to show that there was actually a good deal more continuity in the use of violence as a measure for terrorizing Jews from 1933, 1938, and has normally been acknowledged or recognized in the scholarship. My work builds really on some other recent scholarship that has been produced by a couple of German scholars, one in particular, Michael Wildt, who is based in Berlin, who's done a very important, a very influential book that just came out a couple of years ago, documenting much of the anti-Jewish violence that occurred in Germany between 1933 and 1938. So, you know, questions of continuity and discontinuity are important, you know, for all historians working on almost any subject in any field. And one of the things I try to do in this book is to show that the Kristallnacht that there was a bit more continuity in anti-Jewish violence from the beginning of Nazi rule through the Kristallnacht that has more continuity than we've really recognized. It wasn't quite the rupture. It didn't quite come out of nowhere the way that it's often presented as having been. Mm-hmm. Now, I shouldn't overstate this, which is to say that the degree, the magnitude of the violence and the intensity of the violence in November 1938 was absolutely unprecedented, but neither did it basically materialize out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm. So what sort of anti-Semitic violence do we find in the record, and where do we find it in the record prior to 1938? Just, you know, give an example that Americans will know, because Americans are listening. We know that we have a history of lynchings and race riots in the United States. Is there anything right like that on a local level in Germany prior to 1938? Does a town kind of explode? I don't know. Does Koblenz have a synagogue burning episode or anything like that?
I think your question about the comparison of the anti-Jewish violence in Germany between 33 and 38 on the one hand, and the violence directed against African Americans in the American South, say, during the Jim Crow years on the other hand, I think that's a very valid comparison. I think one can very fruitfully analyze the situation in Nazi Germany based on the record in the American South. There were certainly no national level, centrally organized anti-Jewish violence between 33 and 38. But what you did have was local groups of Germans, locally based groups of Germans, usually organized either in local, a local chapter of the Nazi Party or a local chapter of the SA, the Stormtroopers, who are, of course, an element within the Nazi Party. And they carry out harassment, intimidation, low-level street violence against Jews. This is much more pronounced in some communities than others, and why you see it in some communities and not in others very often depends on local conditions and the the strategies employed by the local Nazi leaders. Mm-hmm. You know, Nazi Germany was a dictatorship, but the local and regional leaders of the party actually had a great degree of latitude mm-hmm. in how they could and would implement the priorities, the program and priorities of the party.
Mm-hmm.
And so technically this violence was, it was illegal. It was not officially ordered. There were a lot of, you know, there was a lot of whispering and a lot of winking and a lot of behind the scenes conversations, and acts of violence would be perpetrated against, you know, Jewish shops would be vandalized, Jews would be, you know, challenged on the street and hit or beaten up, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the authorities would basically look the other way.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning of the Nazi regime, you actually had some authorities who wouldn't look the other way. You know, before the Nazi dictatorship consolidated itself to the point where the authority of the, you know, of the Nazi movement was unchallenged. Now, you still did have during the 1930s, you know, like police officials, local prosecutors, and so forth, who did not approve of this kind of action.
Mm-hmm.
They may have even been themselves, you know, anti-Semitic, mm-hmm. but they just didn't believe that, you know, random street violence was a way to implement a policy platform.
Mm-hmm.
You know, over time, as the Nazi hold on power in Germany became stronger and stronger, it became very difficult for these civil servants who disapproved of these kinds of actions to, you know, to really do anything
mm-hmm.
about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see.
We do, yeah. And some, you know, very often this violence was encouraged from very, very high levels of the regime. For example, in the city of Berlin, you know, the Gauleiter, the Nazi district leader for the city of Berlin, was Joseph Goebbels,
mm-hmm.
who was also the propaganda minister and who was, you know, a really vicious anti-Semite. And, you know, he was very personally frustrated, you know, that as late as, say, you know, 1938, you know, in the spring and summer of 1938, after, you know, half a dozen years of Nazi rule, that there were still tens of thousands of mm-hmm. Jews in the city, and they still owned businesses, and they mm-hmm. still owned, you know, real estate, and they could still walk, you know, they could still promenade on the boulevards, you know, unmolested. There mm-hmm. were still Jewish synagogues that were functioning and that kind of thing. And he found this unacceptable, as did many kind of rank and file members of the Nazi party. And, you know, he basically gave a green light to the local Nazi, to some local Nazi activists to, you know, carry out a fairly widespread program of kind of violence targeted primarily against Jewish property.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Hitler wasn't, even though Hitler himself did not order every, you know, he was not involved in the implementation of every detail of anti-Jewish policy. He did keep abreast
mm-hmm.
of what people under him were doing. And from time to time, in this case that I described with respect to Goebbels, but also in other cases as well, from time to time, Hitler had to kind of personally intercede to put a halt to this kind of violence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, normally he looked the other way, you know, let these people have their fun, let the good, loyal anti-Semitic Nazis vent their wrath against the Jewish community,
mm-hmm.
as long as they didn't push it so far that it would kind of, you know, raise serious questions in the eyes of millions of Germans about whether the Nazi Party was, you know, really kind of in control. You know, there were millions of Germans who, while they may have approved of much of what the Nazi government was doing with respect to economic policy and foreign policy, still insisted on, you know, maintaining order in the streets of Germany. And, you know, wide-scale vandalism against private property, even if it was Jewish property, is something that a lot of people didn't approve of. Mm-hmm. And so from time to time, Hitler had to basically intervene and order the people below, you know, to rein in the people below, you know, when there was some concern over the, you know, the image of Germany among German moderates or Germany's image abroad.
Mm-hmm. No, I see. Let's actually move on to the Kristallnacht itself. One question that I had that really was prompted by what you just said, that if everything you say is true, and I believe that it is, then the Nazi Party officials, that is Goebbels and Hitler and so on and so forth, they knew that there was a certain amount of restraint already being exercised by the party, so that if they let the hounds loose, so to say, that they would or could produce something like Kristallnacht.
Right.
Would that be correct?
I think that's a good way of putting it. They understood that the potential existed within the rank and file of the Nazi Party and within certain circles in the German population that were not in the party but were sympathetic, that if the restraints were lifted and if the signal was given, they knew that there would be a reservoir or a pool of Germans prepared to carry out violence against the Jewish population.
Why don't you tell us how exactly the restraint was lifted? Let's move on to November 1938 itself.
Sure.
Because one of the interesting and kind of paradoxical things is it seems as if the decision to initiate the pogrom was sort of spontaneous.
That's true. That is not necessarily an original conclusion on my part. I think most historians who specialize in Nazi anti-Jewish policy have for some time now understood that the Kristallnacht had not been planned in advance, that it was a decision kind of made on the spot on November 9th, 1938. Although from time to time, you will read in maybe some more popular treatments of the subject, you will still see echoes of the assertion, which used to be much more commonplace, that the whole thing had kind of been premeditated, and that they were just kind of like waiting for the right moment.
Mm-hmm.
The event that really kind of sparked the pogrom happened on November 7th, on the morning of November 7th, 1938, and this occurred in Paris. A young Jewish teenager, 17-year-old Jew from Poland, Herschel Grunspan, walked into the German embassy in Paris, and exactly what transpired after he walked in remains to this day a mystery, but he ended up shooting a fairly low-level young German diplomat by the name of Ernst von Rath, and the Nazi-controlled German media, that is to say the radio and the newspapers, began immediately to play this up as evidence of a Jewish conspiracy, as an international Jewish conspiracy, to intimidate Germany. Which was, of course, nonsense. I mean, there's no question that whatever Herschel Gruschmann's motivations may have been, and there has been some disagreement about that, and perhaps that's something we want to talk about a little later, but whatever those motivations may have been, they were personal. He wasn't really acting as part of an organized plan. But this was an opportunity now for German propaganda to, illustrate how the supposed international Jewish conspiracy was now attempting to kind of retaliate against Germany for its anti-Jewish policies by, carrying out a premeditated assassination of a German diplomat. What, this was seen as an act of intimidation.
Why did Gruschmann say he did it?
Well, Gruschmann...
Originally. I know that he changes his story.
Right. Well, Gruschmann was from a Polish-Jewish family that had moved to Germany immediately after the First World War, was living in Hanover. And Gruschmann himself became very, as a young man, as an adolescent in Germany, had become very frustrated with the way that he was treated. So his family sent him to Paris to live with some relatives. And then at the end of October 1938, the German government rounded up several thousand Jews in Germany who had been Polish citizens, like the Gruschmann family, and basically shoved them across the Polish border, basically forcibly deported them. But the Poles didn't want them back. As a result, these thousands of Jews, including Gruschmann's family, ended up living in a kind of no man's land between Germany and Poland, right on the border, and for quite some time. And it was the early winter, the nights were cold and so forth, sanitation and nutrition were problematic and so forth. So these people were suffering, and Gruschmann claimed that he was basically retaliating against the Germans for the ill treatment of not only his family but his people by the Nazi regime. He claimed to be acting basically not as part of a conspiracy, but basically on behalf of his own oppressed family and people.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important to say that they actually were oppressed. I mean, imagine, just to put it in American context, if the United States decided that it would round up legal Mexican immigrants and then shove them across the border to Mexico, and the Mexican government refused to take them and they would live there on the Rio Grande. I would be a little bit miffed too if I were one of these people.
Right. Oh, of course. I mean, nobody could argue that that Gruschmann wasn't very justifiably upset. The Jewish community in France was very angry at Gruschmann because they were already kind of under fire politically by some sectors of French society and the French media for trying to undermine a rapprochement between France and Germany, and the last thing the Jewish community in France wanted was to become associated with an act of violence perpetrated against a German diplomat. Mm-hmm. So, Gruschmann may have kind of subjectively and sincerely believed that he was doing something positive on behalf of his people, but his own people in France didn't really see it that way.
And his timing, I was going to say his timing was bad in the sense that 2 days later, the most important event in the Nazi celebratory calendar, if I'm not incorrect, takes place.
Right. So what happens is, starting on the 7th, on the day of the shooting, and then for the next couple of days, the German media are basically harping on this case, you know, building up resentment against the Jewish community. And then on the 9th of November, Ernst von Rath, the German diplomat who was shot, actually dies. And the 9th of November is no ordinary day in Nazi Germany. In fact, the 9th of November is, you know, the single most important day on the Nazi ritual calendar. Mm-hmm. It's the anniversary of the Bierhol Putsch of 1923. And so in 1938, it's the 15th anniversary. That's kind of a round anniversary. Yeah. The highlight of every November 9th is a kind of ceremonial reenactment of the events of November 1923 in Munich, where the Bierhol Putsch had been attempted. So it's a day of ceremonial commemoration of the martyrdom of several Nazis in 1923. And one of the points I try to argue in the book is that the Nazi regime or from the in the Nazi mentality, the Nazi understanding of history, the Nazi worldview posits that all of the problems of Germany, you know, during the Weimar period, and the very problems that provoked the Bierhol Putsch in the first place in 1923, you know, the Treaty of Versailles and the loss of German colonies and the occupation of the Rhineland by the Western Allies and the Germany's economic problems, and most notably, you know, the recession, the inflation, the hyperinflation of 1923. All of these things were, you know, laid at the door of Germany's internal enemies, the same internal enemies who supposedly had stabbed Germany in the back during at the end of the First World War. Mm-hmm. And these, of course, were communists, socialists, and above all, Jews. And, you know, from the Nazi point of view, they subscribed to this notion of Judeo-Bolshevism. They basically believed that communism was, you know, a Jewish plot. So the martyrs of the Bierhol Putsch in 1923 were basically, you know, people who had been victimized by Jews. And now you have 15 years later, on the very day that earlier Nazi martyrdom was being commemorated, you have a new Nazi martyr, Ernst von Rath. And while he was a relatively low-level German diplomat, the German media built him into a much more prominent figure than he really was. And as all of this was happening on the 7th of November, the 8th of November, and during the day on the 9th of November, you actually see the eruption of anti-Jewish violence on a kind of localized level in various places in Germany, almost particularly in and around the city of Kassel, mm-hmm. in kind of north-central Germany, in an area known as electoral Hesse. And, you know, this is where that continuity with the pre-1938 violence mm-hmm. comes in.
So these are more or less these are spontaneous. We would call them spontaneous as opposed to what followed.
Yeah, well...
you want to be careful with that word, I understand.
Yeah, that's a tough term. And, you know, I tried my best using some of the post-1945 trial materials, mm-hmm. as I say, historical materials, testimony and other material that was generated by the trials of the perpetrators of the Kristallnacht. Before West German courts, mm-hmm. or before courts in occupied Germany, I tried my best to kind of reconstruct what happened in those communities on the 7th of November and the 8th of November and during the day on the 9th of November, that mm-hmm. is to say, in that period of roughly, 48 to 72 hours mm-hmm. before the eruption of the nationwide pogrom on the night of November 9th,
mm-hmm.
there were most certainly, I'm not sure I can say that they were spontaneous, even though there were elements of spontaneity. Certainly there were individual people who, once given the opportunity to join into the violence, joined in spontaneously.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual local anti-Jewish riots during that period from the 7th to the 9th were probably, most probably, organized, but organized at the local level.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't ordered from Berlin or from Munich, where much of the Nazi leadership was already congregating for the November 9th commemorations, but local Nazi officials, that is to say, fairly low-level Nazi officials, as they had been doing all along between 33 and 38, now took it upon themselves to organize anti-Jewish actions.
Mm-hmm. And is it? I was going to say it's Goebbels' idea originally, and then he takes it to Hitler. Can you describe? There's a great scene in the book shows Goebbels talking to Hitler on the evening of November 9th. And apparently
right.
they're seen, but no one can hear what they're saying. But you
right.
kind of reconstruct what they're saying.
Yeah. Well, one of the arguments I make in the book is that the localized anti-Jewish riots of November 7th, 8th, and then the daytime of November 9th were actually not Goebbels' idea.
Yeah.
But they originated really kind of in local Nazi organizations. That Goebbels was aware that this was happening, and it was his idea, you know, to basically embrace that violence that was now percolating up from below, and to organize it centrally, and to really kind of now give the Nazi activists throughout the country and their sympathizers, you know, more broadly in German society, an opportunity to vent.
Mm-hmm.
And the scene that you were talking about on the evening of November 9th, one of the highlights of this annual commemoration of the Beer Hall Putsch, was that the Nazi leadership, all of the highest level leaders of the party and the government, and all of the Gauleiter, the regional leaders and the leaders of all of the various Nazi auxiliary organizations, they would meet for dinner. You know, the whole hierarchy of the Nazi regime would be in the same room. And this happened on the evening of November 9th. And if you've ever been to Munich, or if your listeners have ever been to Munich, you've probably actually seen the room where this happened
mm-hmm.
because it's right on the Marienplatz, that central square, you know, where the Glockenspiel is that all of the tourists go to see. And it's a building called the Old Town Hall, which is the older of, I mean, the new town hall in Munich is also very old looking, but this is a much older building, which is kind of off to the right if you're looking at the Glockenspiel. And it's been, and Hitler was sitting with Goebbels, and many of the people in the room who later testified about it witnessed them having a kind of very agitated conversation. And then very uncharacteristically, you know, in a departure from previous practice at those November 9th dinners, Hitler got up very abruptly and left.
Mm-hmm.
Normally he wouldn't have done that. And then Goebbels, a couple of minutes later, stood up and informed everybody in the room that the Führer had authorized a nationwide action against the Jews, and that he basically explained the synagogues should be attacked and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Hitler left. He was the leader of Germany, but he had just authorized an action that was illegal. Even according to German law of that day, it was illegal. Certainly, you know, his standing as an international statesman, as the leader of, you know, an important European country, would have been compromised, you know, had he himself kind of, you know, openly in front of all of these people, ordered violence, you know, against a domestic, minority.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And then what transpires is the word goes out to the local party officials by telegram and by telephone. People are running to telephones to contact their local party cells. That's what we'd call them in the Soviet Union. I don't know what they were called in Nazi Germany. But the word goes down the hierarchy to the local level.
Right.
And I think one of the most fascinating things in the book, at least the one that is most memorable about these, is a moment where the communication as to what is to be done is misunderstood. And the message is not you're supposed to go burn synagogues or incite a pogrom, but you're supposed to kill the Jews. And what is fascinating to me about this is that the people that receive the order don't really blink. Maybe you could tell that story.
Right. Well, some do blink. Yeah. But, you're right that others don't. Well, of course, you know, there's no email. There's no cell phones. So, you know, here you have a decision being made on the spur of the moment that now needs to be communicated in, you know, a fairly large country that, you know, has, you know, 70 million people or so. So after hearing, well, one thing that needs to be said is that the Goebbels gave this order to the assembled Nazi leaders verbally. And maybe some of them kind of jotted some things down, but others probably didn't. And so, you know, they're all sitting in Munich, and they now have to communicate this order to Cologne and Hamburg and so forth. So they all go kind of scrambling out of this meeting hall, you know, looking for phones or access to, you know, telegraph or teletype, you know, just some way to kind of communicate with their offices. And it's late at night. People have been drinking. It had been a very, very busy day. There was kind of a lot of room for confusion. And on the other end, that is to say, you know, in Hamburg or Cologne or, you know, in any number of places, the people on the other end of the line, you know, may have already gone home or gone to sleep. So the actual transmission of the order, you know, given the technology of the time, and, you know, given the fact that people that the Nazi organization had not been sitting around waiting for such an order, right? That it had not been planned. It was very, very chaotic, and there was a tremendous potential, really, for miscommunication. And the order kind of did get garbled in many cases, and some people on the receiving end, not only when they received a phone call from Munich, but you know what would happen is that the Gauleiter in Munich would call, say, his office, say, up in Hamburg, and the book has an example about, Bremen. The book has an example about Bremen, you know, the other side of the country. So they'd call somebody in Bremen, and somebody in Bremen would take the call, and then that person would have to communicate the order downward to all of the, you know, through these kind of, you know, concentric circles of the Nazi organization. So there was a whole kind of, you know, chain of communication by telephone. And everything, you know, and since there was no written order, it was basically a chain of telephone calls. And every telephone call contained carried with it the potential of a further miscommunication. And finally, you know, when at the most local level, this order was received, you know, there were cases in which people thought that they were receiving an order to actually kill Jews.
Mm-hmm.
This gets back to what you were saying earlier, is that some of them didn't blink. Right? Some of them did. Some of them were kind of incredulous. It's not that they weren't anti-Semitic, but they, you know, it was possible to be an anti-Semitic Nazi and not be a murderer.
Mm-hmm.
I
was going to say, I found that particular anecdote fascinating and revealing. And for those of you who will read the book, and I hope a lot of people will, it's told in great detail. And yeah, you actually have a certain amount of sympathy, I hate to say it, for the individual who does blink and says he does not want to do it, and then is more or less forced, I don't know if forced is the right word, to kill an elderly Jewish doctor. But
right.
It really is sort of moving in a way. Again, you can't really have sympathy for a murderer, but nonetheless, it kind of gets right to the paradoxes that I think many Germans faced when wanting to be loyal to the Nazi regime meant murdering innocent people.
One of the reasons that I make the point of, you know, reconstructing stories like that in detail is to make my book relevant to scholars and students who, you know, have an interest in, you know, that larger question of the motivations of the perpetrators of the Holocaust. You know, in that particular respect, my book kind of links up, you know, with the debates, you know, over, you know, Daniel Goldhagen's Hitler's willing executioners, and mm-hmm. you know, his debate with Christopher Browning,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. That, you know, one of the central questions is how do ordinary people, in this case, these were members of the Nazi Party, but not necessarily people who are kind of, you know, hardcore, you know, ideological murderers, but how do these people become murderers?
Mm-hmm.
And most of the scholarship on that subject has been focused on the actual years of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I try to do in the book is kind of move that up to 1938. There were several dozen murders perpetrated in connection with the Kristallnacht. And, you know, at least in some of those cases, we can examine, you know, to what extent ideology was a factor and to what extent other forces were involved. And in the case that you're describing, what I try to show is that the person who actually committed the murder was reluctant, and, you know, in the end, he kind of acquiesced to the peer pressure
mm-hmm.
of other Nazis, you know, his Nazi comrades. So he himself was reluctant, but he ended up doing it. On the other hand, I think that the anecdote also demonstrates that many of his colleagues, even though they weren't the ones to actually pull the trigger, but many of his colleagues were very keen to kill this
mm-hmm,
Jew.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And you do a good job of connecting this particular event with that, what is really quite large literature on the perpetrators of the Holocaust, just so. One of the things that we're running out of time, but one of the things I really wanted to hear you talk about was the attempt by the Nazis to put Grunspan on trial. And one of the things that you point out there is that there seems to be, and this I found truly astonishing and eye-opening, on the part of the prosecutors, no doubt that he was part of some international Jewish conspiracy. In other words, they were not using this cynically, as we might expect. They really believed that there was such an international Jewish conspiracy. How could they believe that?
Well, they were prisoners of ideology. They would be neither the first nor the last such people to fit that description. You know, one of the things I try to argue in the book is that, you know, they themselves could never really figure out, you know, if they were absolutely certain that Grunspan had been kind of recruited by some international Jewish conspiracy, and they had put the gun in his hand and told him what to do and so forth. And they continued to believe this, even though as hard as they tried, they could never construct what even to them was a plausible scenario or a convincing scenario of how that actually happened. At one point in the book, I can't remember exactly how the line goes, but I say something like, you know, the only scenario that they didn't seriously entertain was the possibility that Grunspan actually acted alone.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
You know, which is the explanation that is most consistent with all of the evidence.
It's just so difficult for me to enter that mindset. I don't know why. Maybe it's because of the way I was brought up. Or American skepticism or something. I don't believe most of anything, but it's just so hard to enter that mindset that you could actually think that there is this.
Soviet historian. I mean,
yeah. there was an international capitalist conspiracy. It was called capitalism. You know, we went to war against them. I mean, they weren't completely paranoid, but this one seems to have been just invented almost whole cloth. It's very hard for me to understand exactly how they could seriously believe that. I can certainly understand how they could use it as a cynical political ploy to mobilize the German people to whatever rational end they might have. But it's really hard for me to understand how these quite intelligent people could think that there was some international Jewish conspiracy out there in the absence of almost any evidence that there was.
Well, I don't think that having a high IQ necessarily exempts one from theological self-delusion.
No, yeah. Pardon
me. One of the things I demonstrate in the book, I think, is that these two people in particular, one of them, Dieverge, who was propaganda ministry official, you know, kind of in charge of orchestrating. Not only all of the, not only was the original kind of narrative about Grunspan acting on behalf of the international jury, that all was that kind of his invention, but he was also one of the key people involved in the orchestration of the trial during the early 1940s, the trial that actually never took place. But he actually had a post-war career in West Germany. He was involved in a kind of a circle of unreconstructed or kind of only partially reconstructed Nazis who had gravitated toward the Free Democratic Party in the 1950s, the so-called Naumann Circle, taking its name from one of the propaganda ministry officials, Werner Naumann. And he actually believed, even in the 1950s, he was absolutely convinced that Grunspan had acted, you know, on orders from some kind of, you know, Jewish conspiracy.
Yeah, this is just, I just find all of that completely bizarre. Let me ask you just a final question, because I think that our listeners will want to know. They can find out if they read the book. What happens to Grunspan?
Well, he's probably killed. You know, as I describe in the book, The trial did not actually materialize because Grunspan began to argue to his German interrogators. You know, once he was in German custody, he began to argue to them that he had actually previously known Ernst von Ratz, his victim in Paris, and that, in fact, they had been involved in a homosexual relationship. And whether this is true or plausible is a very complicated issue, and I try to remain agnostic about that in the book. I think one could probably write an entire book on that question.
Mm-hmm.
But
if it wasn't true, it was brilliant.
Well, it was. Well, it was. Yeah. Well, it may very well have been a strategy to basically deter the Germans from putting him on trial. And it was brilliant, as you said, in the sense that it actually worked. We do have, one of the sources that I use in the book is the diary of Joseph Goebbels. And Goebbels was absolutely convinced that this was a lie.
Uh-huh.
Since Jews lie, this is, you know, yeah. Just another example of this phenomenon at work.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that once the decision was made not to go forward with this show trial, then Grünspan basically became dispensable.
Yeah.
And he was most likely
mm-hmm.
killed.
Mm-hmm.
There were rumors after the war that he was alive and living in Paris, kind of, you know, under a pseudonym, which struck some people as plausible, given that, as I mentioned earlier, you know, what he did in November 1938 did not actually ingratiate him with mm-hmm. a lot of people in the Jewish community in Paris. So the argument was that he had good reason, if he was still alive, to remain anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
But that probably wasn't the case. He was probably killed in a concentration camp mm-hmm. during the war in 1942 or 1943.
I see. Well, Alan, we've taken up a lot of your time. I really appreciate it. I could talk about this for another hour probably, and I imagine the listeners could listen, but I want to thank you very much for speaking with us today about your new book. The new book is Kristallnacht, 1938. Alan, we have a traditional final question on the show, and that is, what is your next project? What are you working on now?
Oh, well, good question. I'm actually entertaining a couple of different possibilities. One would be a kind of general synthetic history of Nazi Germany. And the other, a much narrower project, I'm very interested in a figure named Georg Elser, somebody who many of your listeners may have never heard of.
I certainly haven't.
Yeah, he was the person who came very close to assassinating Hitler in November of 1939.
Uh-huh.
He was he acted alone. He was a relatively simple person. He was a Shriner, an expert carpenter, cabinet maker, and clockmaker.
Hmm.
Who, through a very kind of ingenious plot, knowing that Hitler on November 9th, 1939, would be giving a speech in, again, you know, this again relates to the annual anniversary of the Beer Hall, which Kristallnacht 1 year earlier did. Knowing that Hitler was going to give a speech in the same place that he did every year, he actually managed to plant a bomb inside a kind of an architectural structural column in the meeting hall, and only by virtue of the fact that Hitler concluded his speech early and left was Hitler's life spared because the bomb actually blew up as Elser had planned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it ended up killing quite a few people who mm-hmm. were still in the meeting hall, and if Hitler had been at his podium when the bomb went off, he would have most likely been killed as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know a lot about the July 20th, 1944 plot that also came close to killing Hitler. That mm-hmm. was the plot of the military officers mm-hmm. led by Stauffenberg,
yeah.
Yeah, obviously, you know, Hollywood films have been made about that and so forth. We know much less about Elser, and that case hasn't received nearly as much play. And mm-hmm. I'm interested not only in Elser himself and what may have motivated him, but also in why, since the end of World War II, that particular case hasn't received nearly as much attention as the Stauffenberg plot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. That's an interesting question. Well, whichever topic you pick, I hope that you will reappear on the show here because it's been very enjoyable talking to you. Again, the book is Kristallnacht 1938, and we've been talking to Alan Steinweiss about it. And Alan, thank you very much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure, and thanks very much for having read my book so carefully.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Take care now.
You too.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Alan Steinweiss about his new book, Kristallnacht, 1938. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.